This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. To learn more, visit rt11.com.
Our restaurant delivery system is broken. Can we all just agree on this? Restaurants are getting hammered with percentage of sales fees, delivery drivers are hurting for fair pay, stability, and safety, and customers have been trained to expect faster delivery times and wider accessibility.
So we are excited to welcome back to the show. This is our first repeat guest, so we are very excited. It's the first time ever in opening soon. It's long history of 3 years. No, I'm just kidding. So Josh Morgan is here with us today. He's the operating partner of Melt Shop and the CEO, co-founder of Sesame, which is a new delivery platform for restaurants by restaurateurs. They are fighting back against the established aggregators, and Sesame actually just launched its beta in New York City this past week. So thank you for joining us.
Welcome back.
Thank you so much. It's so great to be here. And I am deeply honored and humbled to be a repeat guest.
I love it. I know, I was just saying that, you know, you just need to keep on opening stuff so we keep on having things to talk on opening soon about. But I love it. We love serial entrepreneurs on the show and just in general. But I think it's really interesting. You know, you obviously, we talked about this a little bit before, but you reached out at a very interesting time because there's obviously been a lot of talk about fixing the delivery system, the drivers, the platforms, all the things. So tell us.
We were literally like talking about that morning and how messed up it was, and you emailed or called or whatever in the afternoon.
So perfect timing. It worked out. The universe is telling us something that we all needed to reconvene and really talk this out, because it's a huge problem, and we're excited about, you know, trying to potentially solve it.
So tell us a little bit about Sesame and what makes it different and what you guys are trying to solve and accomplish.
Yeah, of course. So first and foremost, you know, I'm a career restaurateur, you know, and we talked about this on our first podcast, but I've dedicated, you know, most of my career to the hospitality and restaurant business, driven really by a passion for creating experiences for our guests and, you know, building brands along the way. And I've loved it. And I've had the good fortune of working for incredible companies like Orify Brands, you know, Houston's, you know, the Made Nice team. And, you know, I think first, the first thing we really want to do is look at this problem from the lens of people who actually live it and breathe it every day. And, you know, this industry has been, you know, pervaded by Silicon Valley and big tech. Not that that in and of itself is bad, but, you know, sometimes solving problems unique to a specific industry requires people that understand the nuances of running businesses within that industry. So first and foremost, that's why we created, or why we thought we would be the best people to kind of solve some of these problems, because we love this business and we're passionate about it, and we want to not only solve problems, but we want to create solutions that provide for the betterment of the entire collective industry. And that's founders, owners, operators, team members, delivery drivers, like everybody that impacts this valuable system, you know, we want to solve problems for. And we just, again, felt that the validation of being restaurant people would put us in a better place. And, you know, when COVID hit, you know, we had at Orify, we have about 120 restaurants across 6 different brands. So, you know, when COVID hit, we were just picking up the pieces and trying to, you know, plot our path forward, which was very difficult, not only for the restaurant industry, but clearly everyone globally. But what it made me do is it forced me to kind of think about some of the fundamental problems that exist in our industry. And I very quickly landed on off-premise, which had seen a large, you know, proliferation in the years leading up to the COVID. But when COVID hit, it just kind of was this realization or an epiphany that this is so bad and this is so not sustainable, because when off-premise sales go from, you know, maybe 10% or below pre-COVID to, you know, operating restaurants where it's like 60%, 70% of your sales in this cataclysmic, you know, environment, which certainly isn't normal, but it kind of smacks you in the face and it's like, wait a minute. If this can't work at like 10, 15%, how the heck is it going to work at 60% of sales? So it was just really
restaurants were on one of the other platforms at the time.
Yeah, so most of our restaurants are fast casual in nature, with the exception of one brand, Little B Table. But and so we've been kind of battling the, you know, the off-premise game for several years. So most of our properties were, you know, kind of casting this wide net. I use that term a lot because it really shows how the industry has evolved. There used to be this notion that, you know, you would maybe be on one platform and that's it. And then you would just drive all the other traffic or as much traffic as you could through your proprietary channel, which is, you know, our owned intellectual property, like meltshop.com, littlebeat.com, fiveguys.com. And then over the years in the chase for incremental sales, restaurants started to just turn on all channels, you know, everything that you could, that was feasible, just to try to compete and to get more sales and hopefully get incremental profit. And then over the years, we just realized, and again, because COVID, you know, hit us in the face, we realized that just by turning on incremental sales doesn't mean that you're always getting incremental profit. And this is kind of one of the big, you know, the bigger topics that I think of as being duped. You know, I think the industry was kind of duped by big tech in that they promised this idea of incremental sales, and the natural belief was that those incremental sales would flow down to your bottom line. And what we realized, especially when you add in layers of, you know, cannibalization, you know, these aggregators stealing our own in-house guests, that the contribution margin wasn't there. So, you know, when you really distill down and you look at the numbers, it just doesn't make sense, even at lower sales volumes, you know, that we're turning on all of these channels and yet we're not really seeing return on those sales dollars. So those are just all additional reasons why the system is so broken.
I agree. I think that, you know, it's interesting you say that the restaurants were duped. I think the customers in a lot of ways too are duped and brainwashed. And that this idea that I can and should order food from 100 miles away, expect it in 20 minutes and expect to pay $8 for it. And for all of that to just sort of work out.
Exactly.
It's just not the way that, you know, we grew up eating or ordering delivery food. And it certainly doesn't make any sense to me sustainably. So it's really interesting to hear that you've worked on something new. Did you guys have other thoughts before, you know, Sesame came about? Did you think about taking it in-house for each of your concepts? Is it possible to go back to a phone call system? Like, did you try that?
Yeah. I mean, look, for years, we've been kind of contemplating internally how we can get better at driving traffic through our channels and the ones that we control, which are inherently more profitable. But it's just such a challenge. And the main reason is because most restaurateurs, and Sesame really targets, you know, we're hoping to help all restaurants in all neighborhoods, but, you know, a real sweet spot are the independents, the mom and pops, you know, the local neighborhood establishments. And the challenge for them is that restaurateurs are really, really great at a lot of things, culinary innovation and hospitality, taking care of their guests, making connections with the community. But when it comes to becoming a digital entrepreneur, it's just very, very difficult. It's become so sophisticated and so challenging. And it's just, it's tough for the independents. So we at Orify Brands always thought, like, how do we get better at becoming digital entrepreneurs? And, you know, we spent a lot of time and money and resources building out our own proprietary channels that are powered by various types of tech stacks. But even doing that, it's difficult, it's challenging, it's expensive, it's very fragmented. And what we found in kind of doing this deep dive into the business model of Sesame is that, you know, consumers now are addicted to the Amazon, you know, search and discovery, high digital touch point, a really, really great consumer experience with lots of convenience. And what the industry did in response to the proliferation of the aggregators was they went headfirst into this proprietary channel. We're going to hope that all of our fans and all of our consumers come to meltshop.com and download the Meltshop app, then go to Little Beat and download the Little Beat app. And after years and years of this, what we found in talking to consumers is that there's destination fatigue. You know, there's app fatigue. Consumers, again, want convenience all in one place. And there wasn't a lot of people out there competing in that kind of traditional marketplace search and discovery. And, you know, Sesame, that's one of the reasons why Sesame where we decided to build Sesame as a marketplace that offered some of those value propositions I just alluded to compete with the, you know, DoorDash and Grubs and Uber Eats of the world. And it's because we knew and we saw that there was this pinch point from consumers that, you know, it's just too fragmented. It's too difficult putting in your credit card into 10 different places. And you know, really, like, how many friends do we know that, you know, prefer to go to, you know, 6 different places on their list of, you know, favorite restaurants rather than go to ideally one place and have it all in, you know, get it done in one shot. So those are some of the things that we kind of thought about when we were ideating what Sesame could look like and how it could be structured. But to your question earlier, Alex, you know, we've been trying for years, and, you know, Sesame in and of itself isn't a novel idea in the sense that, you know, disrupting aggregators in favor of the merchants themselves. I mean, you can look into any industry, whether it be hotel and travel and airline. You know, this fight has been played over many times, just not necessarily in this space. But, you know, one good way to think about it or look at it, and maybe your listeners will appreciate this, is this was done recently with the reservation industry in the way that Resy had kind of combated against the behemoth of OpenTable, and really did so by, you know, deciding that, number one, they wanted to help the merchants, you know, collect more money and make more money off of these new users. And, you know, they did it by essentially saying that, you know, you don't need to pay commissions. Like, you don't need to pay an infinite amount of money, you know, the more reservations you get. And they kind of transitioned to the SaaS model, and it worked really, really well. Resy was acquired by Amex a couple of years ago, and they did a lot of great things on both the merchant side as well as the consumer side. And we're just trying to take some of those learnings and best practices, and again, a mission of giving back to the actual restaurateurs and creating a similar business model and disrupt in a very similar way.
So, and tell our listeners, because I don't think we actually described the business model for Sesame. So what makes it different to the restaurateurs' bottom lines? How are you changing that model?
So fundamentally, what we're doing is we're taking the current playbook and the business model that the aggregators use, which are rooted in two primary things: commission-based monetization. So the more orders or sales restaurants receive off of these platforms, the more dollars they pay. And it's infinite. You know, we know restaurants that do tremendous volume on places like Caviar or Uber Eats, and they might pay, you know, $10,000, $15,000. We know some that are even paying over $20,000 a month in the form of commissions. And on Sesame, you pay $125, right? So that's the difference between a commission-based or a transaction-based monetization and a SaaS model, which is fixed and capped. So that's number one. So when you compare those two numbers, it's kind of crazy to think about, but, you know, $20,000 versus $125, that delta is almost all profit. You know, that goes straight to the bottom line. So it's hugely, hugely impactful to a restaurant's profitability. So that's number one. Another thing that is fundamental is this notion of data. And in the current model that the aggregators use, in fact, DoorDash and Grub and Uber are suing New York City and San Francisco right now, specifically over this data issue, is that we believe in an open data model where the restaurants should be able to know their customers, cater to their customers, and that they should have access to the information when a consumer places an order from their favorite restaurants. The current models restrict that, and they do not allow restaurants to get access to that data. So that's another fundamental difference of how Sesame is trying to compete.
Interesting. I wouldn't have realized that necessarily. So at the restaurant, you don't get any information on the customer?
No, you might get name, but you don't get, you know, the most important thing are things email. Like email and yeah. or phone numbers for SMS. So not all of that is encrypted and restricted. So what happens is, and this is why it's such a predatory type of industry, because DoorDash and some of these guys have gotten so good at retargeting consumers that they can take, you know, a Melt Shop customer that either comes to Melt Shop or uses the Melt Shop proprietary channel. They can retarget them, you know, get them to use DoorDash or Uber, get their information and do a much better job at retargeting that customer than Melt Shop can. And it's a challenge, like I said, because restaurateurs typically aren't these digital entrepreneurs who are savvy at this. So owning that data and utilizing it effectively is an important thing. So
when a customer comes to Sesame and like orders, they opt in for the restaurant basically to also receive their data, and then the restaurant automatically gets access to the phone number, the email, and whatever, so they can like do their own marketing.
Exactly. And, you know, look, there's a wide spectrum of sophistication, across restaurants and what they do with data. Some of the restaurants like ours are pretty active in trying to develop marketing plans and, you know, retention plans to get our fan base, you know, to continue to use our product. Others aren't and don't necessarily have the means and the tools to do so. But either way, we're there to support them and give them the access to that data. And, you know, we support whatever they choose to do with it, whether it's retarget them and drive them to their own channel, or whether it's to continue to support Sesame because the contribution margin for the restaurant is very compelling when orders come off of Sesame due to that low SaaS cost.
So, and then tell us a little bit about how like the fulfillment process works. So you guys are a better, more restaurant friendly sort of platform or marketplace for the restaurants, but tell me about how you're fulfilling the orders.
Yeah, of course. See, look, fulfillment is a huge component of the equation of off-premise, right? And, you know, when we started to think about Sesame and what it might look like, there's a couple things that we kind of stated, out of the gate. One was that, number one, we didn't want to reinvent the logistics wheel, right? I mean, this has been done for many, many years all across the world, and it's very difficult to run efficiently and effectively. So we knew that Sesame didn't want to choose to kind of build one from the ground up. The other thing that we stated from the get-go was that we wanted to not necessarily look at just the most efficient or, cost-effective way to execute delivery, but we wanted to look at delivery from the eyes of the consumer. How do we make sure that the consumer can have the highest likelihood of a high-quality executed experience when ordering from their favorite restaurants? And when you set yourself up looking to solve problems in that vein, what's most important is working with a fulfillment company that has a long history of consistency, scalability, and does things the right way. Meaning they're not only efficient, but they're efficient because they do the right things, like take care of their fleet. They make sure that they're incentivizing their fleet in the appropriate ways. And all of these factors kind of drove us to develop a strategic partnership with a company called Relay, which is based here in New York City. And we know Relay because Relay has been powering our fulfillment and a lot of our brands at Orify for many, many years. And again, they have a proven track record where I'm very close with the founder, Alex, who's a great guy. And we decided to tackle logistics, that way by developing this partnership with Relay. So a restaurant that comes onto Sesame really has two options. One is they can self-deliver, which is great. There's a lot of brands that still try to do that themselves. Or they can work with Relay. And that's kind of how the system is set up now. We may extend that as we scale into other markets, and there are other fulfillment-only companies that we could work with. But for now, it's one of those two options.
And who pays Relay? Does Relay get a percentage of sales, or is that a flat monthly? Like, how does that, or is it like a flat fee per order? How does that work?
Yeah, so the economics on the delivery typically work like this. First of all, most of the restaurants in New York already work with Relay, especially the restaurants that are on Sesame. So they have existing accounts. And the reason that is because Relay's bread and butter has been delivering orders on behalf of those proprietary channels that I mentioned. So when MeltShop got an order through its own channel, Relay's the go-to fulfillment provider, right? So they're all across the city. Pre-COVID, they had, I think, like 7,000 couriers. So a lot of people know Relay. And what happens is Relay will bill the restaurant directly for, let's say, like a $30 check. The cost typically is about $5. There's a bit of a range, but let's just, for purposes of explaining the economics, it's about $5. So the restaurant pays that. And this is, the, you know, this is the big black hole of misinformation and lack of education, where most consumers don't really understand how things work and, you know, what fees go where and who gets paid this. So one of the things that Seth and me were also trying to tackle is just complete honesty and transparency about what's happening behind the scenes and what everything means. What most restaurants do is they have a choice, right? They can pass along a delivery fee. So when all of us, we've all had experience with this, typically when you place an order, you'll see a bunch of line items, one of which is a delivery fee. That delivery fee, sometimes it's $1.99, $2.99, is set by the restaurant. And that's a way that they subsidize the cost of that $5 logistics cost to relay, right? So in essence, the restaurant is basically saying, hey, the consumer will pay a portion of it, and then we'll pay the rest. And that's typically how the economics work for the cost of fulfillment of that delivery. If that, I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, so that it does make sense. So you're, so most people on Sesame are doing like a small delivery fee surcharge, and that is, you know, obviously subsidizing the cost for Relay, who's this like this third party fulfillment service, basically, that is just the delivery fleet.
That's exactly right. And, you know, the industry has evolved over the years. I mean, I remember in the early days of offering delivery, you know, we've been doing it for so long. In the beginning, you know, you couldn't really charge a delivery fee because consumers just simply weren't willing to pay one. And then over the years, as, you know, it's become more popular, off-premise sales have consistently grown. You know, I think consumers have been a little bit more willing to pay some of that cost of delivery. Mainly it's, you know, maybe it's their favorite restaurant that, you know, they love the brand. And, you know how it is when you want your favorite sandwich or your favorite salad, that's all you really want. And I think restaurants have been able to, you know, accumulate kind of a loyal fan base that are willing to pay that cost. And the reality is, and this goes to the education, right? Like nothing is for free, right? Like you can't deliver things from A to B, whether it's food or whether it's, you know, some sort of physical product, like a manufactured product, it costs money. Someone is paying that.
And oh, this, we know.
You know, like, and like this yeah. is, and this gets to what we were talking about earlier, right? Like there's this like the kind of the wool over the eyes of the consumer and leading them to believe that you can get anything you want for no cost at all. Well, the reality is whenever you see $0 on, let's say, Grub or Uber or DashPass or whatever these programs are, it doesn't mean there's no cost. It just means that most likely that platform is willing to eat that cost because their losses, and we're talking about crazy losses, are being subsidized by Wall Street or the investment community. But it's not real, you know?
I mean, I think this is how Amazon ruined consumers, basically, is because Amazon tricked everybody to thinking they got free delivery when in fact they were like losing billions of dollars. And again, like, as you said, it got passed along to the investors and then to the public who owns their stock. But, and it's the same thing that's happening with delivery services. So it's unfortunate. I mean, we know too, from our business, and it's like, if people want your products, they'll pay the delivery charge because somebody has to pay it. Or you know, small businesses can't just afford to lose money because people don't want to pay a delivery fee.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and yeah, totally. And it's an unrealistic expectation that's been set. Yeah. And I think in order to create sustainable business models, we have to do a little bit of education and we have to, you know, teach consumers a little bit more about what's really happening. But at the same time, I'll walk you through some numbers to kind of put this into perspective. But consumers are still paying more than they should, not even, you know, irrespective of this delivery fee that we're talking about. And the reason for that is because these companies are losing a tremendous amount of money and someone's got to pay. It's either the restaurant or the consumer in the current model, right? And let me just give you an example. If you're a consumer and you're going to place a $100 order on, let's say, Sesame versus Caviar. So Caviar typically, as of today, charges 15% service fee, right? So on a $100 order, that's $15. On Sesame, we charge a flat fixed rate, $3. Right. So that's a net savings to the consumer of $12. That's just on the service fee. Service fee, just so everyone knows, that's the line item that you see on any, you know, delivery app that typically goes to the platform itself, just like the Sesame fee actually goes to Sesame. And we make that very, very clear. Right. The other thing at play, which is it has really manifested itself recently, is that restaurants, because they're so used to being charged these high commissions over years and years, they started to increase their menu prices and they add premiums. So the menu prices on caviar might be 15% higher, sometimes 20% higher than they would be if you ordered it directly from the restaurant. So on that same $100 order, there's an additional $15 in cost that the consumer is paying in higher menu prices, right? So when you add those things together, the consumer can save, in theory, up to $27 simply by ordering on Sesame, right? So that's a pretty substantial, if you think of it as a percent, you know, 27% in just fees that they don't have to pay. And the reason why I tie that back to the delivery, it's that if a consumer can save $27 and know that, number one, they're helping their favorite restaurant, they're partaking and participating in a system that offers more sustainability and fairness, they just save money. They might be more apt or willing to happily pay that $2.99 delivery fee because they know that there is a real cost of delivery. So we're really kind of excited to offer not only the benefit to the restaurant, but benefits to the consumers in the form of lower fees.
And speaking of the consumer, so, you know, obviously you've already seen the program is in beta and you're live and you've signed up restaurants. How are you acquiring customers? Because again, that's, you know, a problem with big tech is they'll spend customer acquisition at all costs, even if it's not profitable.
Yeah. I mean, look, that's the big question. And it's not always easy in the current environment where everybody is out there just trying to get the same customers. But the way we're thinking about it is in a bunch of different ways. But first and foremost, it's creating alignment with the restaurants, you know, and we do this, which is very innovative and unique in the marketplace space, simply by not charging those commissions. Right. So for every order that comes off of Sesame, the contribution profit to that restaurant is as good, in some cases better, than it would be on their own proprietary channel. So, and that's because we do not charge commission. So when you start with that, we now have alignment with the restaurants. Like we're sitting, I like to use this analogy, you know, we're sitting on the same table, same side of the table as the restaurateur, whereas the other aggregators are on the opposite side. And because of that, we can do a lot of different things. One of which is we can work together to acquire customers, right? So one thing restaurants have is they typically have a database of loyal consumers that have a lot of brand affinity for that brand. And, you know, like I said, I mentioned this kind of like spectrum of restaurants. You know, some restaurants are very sophisticated when it comes to, you know, marketing. Others aren't. You know, they don't have sophisticated tech stacks and ordering solutions. So with a lot of these restaurants, we can work together to, you know, promote Sesame, let their consumers and user base know that this restaurant is available on Sesame. And if you imagine that at scale, you know, across New York Metro or even across the country, that has a huge impact on consumer acquisition or the customer acquisition costs themselves. And it all goes back to creating that alignment and, you know, mutual benefit and really kind of creating a system that benefits the restaurant as its, you know, primary mission. The second thing that we're doing, which we haven't really talked on, but is so fundamental to Sesame, I want to make sure we don't skip it, is that we really try to create a true mission-driven, you know, company, in that we're not only trying to help the restaurant industry, but we're also trying to give back to the greater community writ large through charitable donations. And an example of this is Sesame has partnered with City Harvest so that every single order placed on Sesame feeds a hungry New Yorker in need. And, you know, we believe that it's like incumbent and it's our duty to not only, you know, again, try to solve some problems for our industry, but in doing so, give back. And instead of doing the traditional helicopter money approach, you know, it's funny, before COVID, I used to get emails from Grub and Uber, you know, $5 off, $10 off. Post COVID, in this race to take market share, I'll regularly get emails, $100 off. I just
what?
Thought,
really?
Yeah. That's, I mean, crazy. It's so common. And really, it's because all they care about is getting market share, you know, like profitability, sustainability, fairness, be damned, right? It's like, we need more market share. And it's kind of gross. I'm sure you're aware of the grocery wars that are happening here in New York. There's 6-7 different companies competing for, you know, fulfillment of, you know, groceries, you know, like Scopuff and Joker and Gorillas. Anyways, I got an email, $500 credit for groceries.
$500.
You know, I mean, it's just, it's not sustainable. And again, Alex, like, you know, to your point, like, this is funny money. This is not sustainable, right? But to put it back into perspective, we at Sesame have basically said, we are not playing that game. Number one, we'll lose that game because they have deeper pockets than we do. But rather than try to just, you know, bribe people with free shit and free sandwiches, we kind of are thinking about it in a way like, look, if you're going to use a delivery app, use the one that feeds the hungry New Yorker. And then slowly educate that same consumer on why it's better for the restaurants and what it means for the long-term sustainability of, you know, the industry and so on and so forth. So we're really just leading with mission much more than free stuff. And I've always been a believer, this goes back to our restaurant brand, you never get brand affinity with giving stuff for free. You know, you get brand affinity by providing true value, developing a relationship with your consumer, and making sure that you're listening to them and always delivering on that value. And that's what creates brand loyalty and affinity. And that's what we're trying to do with Sesame. And so those are some of the ways that we're kind of tackling customer acquisition and trying to be innovative. And look, there's no illusions of grandeur here. We're picking a fight with some behemoths. This is true, David and Goliath. But we just can't help but be encouraged by, you know, the hundreds, thousands of restaurateurs that we've spoken to over the last year, and to hear how frustrated and how much contentiousness there is against these aggregators. And, you know, restaurants call, you know, they refer to Grubhub as the mafia, you know? And then when we talk to consumers and when we hear from them that there's zero brand loyalty or affinity to any of these platforms, they're perceived as commoditized transactional experiences. We just think there's such a large white space to provide that true value in the form of mission, community, and sustainability.
I mean, I think I'm the opposite of what you were talking about before. It's like, I go to the restaurant's websites directly now, just because I'm so over Caviar and Grubhub and all of those things.
Which is amazing.
I've gone old school. I'm calling people again. I'm like, you know.
But it's not easy. It's not again, easy. Like you said, that it's because it's been, you know, prolific for so long that people sometimes just don't even have telephones. Like, they don't have a website that's set up to take orders. They've erased it as something that they need to have or should have, because they've been told that they can't, or that it doesn't make sense financially or whatever it is. But I think it's really, really cool what you're doing. You think your business will also force the current big guys to change, or you think they're going to go down fighting until the end because they just don't have the money to dig back out of the hole?
Well, I mean, I think when we make a big splash, which we're planning to, you know, I think they're going to have to adapt. But the challenge with their business model is they can't really change the economics of the model, right? Either the restaurant has to pay or the consumer has to pay. And to give you an example of this and how I see this continuing for the coming months or years, you know, a lot of municipalities and cities have been passing either temporary or permanent caps on commissions. And the reason why they're doing this is because, yeah, look, it's a sign when the government has to get involved to regulate pricing. Usually something is wrong, right?
Right.
So when COVID hit, New York and San Francisco passed temporary caps on commissions. So it meant that the aggregators could not monetize as much as they could on the backs of restaurants. What did they do? They responded by adding in the consumer facing fees. And they did this in various cities across the country as kind of like a test. You know, in Chicago, if you ordered off of DoorDash, there would be a Chicago surcharge fee of just like a random fee, like $2, $3, right? Because again, if they can't collect it from the restaurant, they got to get it from the customer. And there was huge backlash from consumers. In fact, I believe that Chicago filed like some sort of injunction or lawsuit against DoorDash for implying that it was a Chicago-based fee. But anyways, it didn't work out well. So to answer your question, Alex, I don't think they have many options in changing their economics. The other thing that I think they will do is, and we know they're actually already doing this, and this is one of the reasons why I believe that, you know, the restaurant industry in general is facing an existential threat, is that they're losing so much money that one of the other ways that they can make more money and create profitability, at least they think, is to own the entire supply chain. And by that, I mean, not only will they generate the order, deliver the order, but they're actually going to make the product as well. And all so three of these companies kitchens, are yeah. opening up ghost facilities, you know, ghost kitchens or dark kitchens, which has been very popular over the last couple of years. They're creating their own virtual concepts, and they're literally supplanting the very industry and the operators that they're claiming to support and help, which is a scary proposition, you know?
Yeah. No, I mean, I know there's been like stories of people going in and like searching for a specific restaurant, and the restaurant actually never got the order. It was like fulfilled by like some other ghost kitchen situation. I don't know. Right. It's yeah. That's why I go direct to the restaurant.
It's real, now. but then they'll also pose it to the business as some sort of, you know,
we're marketing for you, blah, blah.
Do all
yeah.
this for you, and all you have to do is supply the recipe or whatever. and then boom, yeah. next thing you know, all your customers are gone.
Exactly. It's a very, you know, kind of scary, you know, evolution of what's happening in this space. And, you know, again, I think, and this was part of the fuel that drove me personally when I was, you know, debating, like, should we tackle this or not, you know, back when COVID started. And I just came to the conclusion that, you know, someone needs to fix this, or someone needs to attempt to try to solve the problem. And if we don't solve it, you know, they're just going to continue to monopolize this business until literally it's beaten to a pulp and unrecognizable, you know, and the unfortunate reality of how this model is set up is that, again, the independents, the small enterprise pay the burden to a much higher degree than the enterprise big companies, you know, like Starbucks and McDonald's and Chick-fil-A, like they get sweetheart deals with these aggregators where, you know, the guy on the street who just opened up his first concept and is a killer, you know, culinary genius, he's the one that pays the biggest price. So
I guess, yeah.
So tell us, I know you're in beta now, and I saw on your site that you are currently from like Soho to 34th Street or something to that range. How do you, when are you out of beta? What do you need to learn before you get to the next step? And, you know, where do you expect to be, and how long do you expect to be there to get more people signed up and on board?
Yeah, look, it's a great question. You know, it's hard to say when we'll be out of beta. You know, we did build a fully proprietary product, meaning the front end app, the marketplace, the back end logic, the whole e-commerce platform is proprietary. So we spent a great deal of time, you know, doing quality control and testing. So part of beta and you know, which is kind of a prototype, is, you know, fine tuning that. And like any digital tech product, it requires fine tuning and validation. So that's part of the reason why we're in a beta and why we are restricting the geography. You know, the good news is that we have unbelievable engineers, and we hired an unreal digital design firm called Frog Design to help us build the front end web app. And, you know, we're unbelievably happy with how it turned out. So that's one of the things that we're focused on. The other thing is the supply. You know, it's in order to build a marketplace, which makes it very daunting, you know, you have to build the supply and the demand at basically the same time, you know, which is tough. So by kind of creating a geographic boundary for the first, you know, several weeks, it allows us to really control and match both the supply with the demand. And, you know, we've got hundreds of restaurants that have told us that they want to be part of Sesame, which again, like, gives us the fuel to kind of keep, you know, driving forward in this Herculean task. But, you know, we got to get them onboarded, and we've got to get the menus and the data and the pictures and everything into Sesame, which, you know, can be somewhat complicated. We've devised a really great system for onboarding, which we're really happy with, but it's just a process. And, you know, we envision that in the, you know, going into the end of the year, you know, we hope to be at, you know, a couple hundred locations, and we'll slowly expand those geographic boundaries and move into new neighborhoods. You know, we've got a great waiting list. Like, we've been talking to restaurants in Brooklyn and Uptown and Harlem Financial District. So we've got a great pipeline when we're ready. And, yeah, we're really enthusiastic about the supply side, and we think, you know, getting consumers aware of Sesame and kind of the compelling value propositions that we think we have to offer, we think that demand will match that supply.
Are you seeing people who come on the platform terminate their relationships with like the other aggregators? Is that the hope? Are you seeing it like as a slow migration?
So the short answer is no, because like I mentioned earlier, you know, everybody is kind of out there kind of casting this wide net and getting as much incremental sales as possible, right? So that's the ammo right now. So most restaurants, by the way, just to be clear, you can be on Sesame and be on all the platforms you want or none of the platforms you want. There's no requirement for exclusivity whatsoever. What I do envision, and this is already happening, like every restaurant we speak to literally hates the current system and wants nothing that would like nothing more than to turn off all these other channels. But the problem is, and this is what I talked about earlier, is until there's an alternative marketplace solution that can generate the demand, and or until the restaurant is maybe a little bit more confident in their ability to generate their own demand through their proprietary channel, it's just very difficult to pull the cord, right? So I do envision a near-term future where we can prove that not only can we create more sustainability for the restaurants, but that we can bring that demand that the aggregators currently offer. And I think there will be a seismic shift when restaurants start to reconsider, you know, their approach to off-premise. And let me give you one specific example. I'm not going to mention the restaurant names, but there's a restaurateur who's been in New York, been in the industry for many, many years. He's launching a new concept with a pretty reputable chef. It's a fast casual concept. And I did a conversation with him about Sesame and their launch. And they originally were planning to open the restaurant with all of the major platforms. So Grub, Uber, DoorDash, and then their own channel. And after the conversation that I had with him, not only because of it, but imparted onto their decision a little bit, was, you know, their final decision to launch just on Sesame and their own channel and kind of hold off on the other platforms. And I had this conversation, I heard this from him about a week ago. And, you know, I think it represents this kind of new post-COVID mindset, which is, there's great, you know, highly talented restaurateurs, you know, chefs and people that are, you know, dipping their toe back into the industry, creating new concepts, and they're learning all the lessons from COVID and off-premise and how important it is to have a digital footprint, but doing so in a way that maybe prioritizes their own sustainability instead of the old playbook. An assumption that I just got to be on all the platforms. So I think it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because themes always emerge when we have these shows. And one theme I think that has been emerging recently is like people are realizing that they shouldn't just keep doing more with shrinking margins. It's like people are realizing like protect the margin in the hospitality industry, which I think is sort of like a first.
Even if that means
even less revenue, right?
So less revenue.
But better
doesn't
margin.
Necessarily mean less profit margin or less happiness. I think, you know, I think a lot of people have realized post pandemic is that you can sacrifice some of that, be happier, have happier employees, and still make more,
still
just
make
as much,
more.
You know, money.
Yeah, no, and I think that's spot on. And I think it's a bit of a, you know, going back to old school approach, right? You know, the restaurant industry, you could make good money in the restaurant industry. Andrew Schnipper has a great brand called Schnippers. He's a friend. And he's been in New York for decades, you know, and we were talking just a couple of weeks ago and he was like, Josh, you could open up a great concept in Manhattan and make, you know, a lot of money, you know, and that was a long time ago. And then unfortunately over the last, you know, decade or a little bit more, you know, the mindset went from how do we create a business entity that has true profitability and sustainability towards a mindset of, how do we just grow market share? And how do we open up as many new locations as possible? Forget about profit. And I think restaurateurs are doing exactly what you just said, Alex. They're basically saying, no, we now need to prioritize our bottom line and sustainability and utilize the tools that give us the most profit.
This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate. an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believe comfort food can be just that. Know where your food comes from. To learn more, visit rt11.com.
This has been a great conversation. I think we should move into a little bit of lightning round. Yeah. Our quick, short, rapid fire answers that we usually have like restaurant focus, but we had to change them for this one, which I'm excited about. So these are new.
You didn't give me the heads up on the lightning round.
Oh, it's okay. It's like quick. You don't remember this from last time. It's quick, one or two word answers. These are softballs.
All good. I'm teasing.
Yeah. Your favorite place to get delivery from right now outside of your RFI team?
I've been ordering Blue Ribbon sushi a lot lately.
Ooh, and that's on Sesame?
Not on Sesame yet, unfortunately.
Oh, come on.
Come on,
Josh.
Not on Sesame yet.
Oh my God. When I order on Sesame, I mean, I literally, you know, we do a lot of ordering internally, you know, just for testing and just because, you know, we order food all the time. I literally do the rotation. Ivan Ramen is one of the spots on Sesame that we added recently. Yeah. That I've been ordering a ton.
Good. Okay. What about average order time? How long does it typically take for a customer's order to arrive versus what's the customer's expectation? Like versus customer expectation.
Yeah. No, between 20 and 25 minutes.
That's fast.
That's pretty fast. And Relay, you know, has a long history, like I said, not only at our brands, but at many, many brands that have been using them at executing on those times.
I mean, the thing I think, I don't know that we talked about Relay's model, but I think what's interesting is that they keep couriers within a specific zone so that they don't have them going all over. You know, it's like with Uber Eats, if you get an Uber driver, they could be going from like the Upper East Side down to the Lower East Side is like makes no sense. So whereas like the way that Relay does it is that they keep people in zones, which makes it faster and is less, you know.
Exactly. One of the things we prioritize is really setting optimal delivery radii. And typically it's about 1.7 miles in Manhattan to execute, you know, those types of delivery times. And restaurants, you know, look, restaurants want to sell a lot of food to a lot of people. And sometimes there's a tendency to want to expand those, you know, that radius to 3 miles, 4 miles. And that's just very, very difficult, not only for the consumer, but for the delivery driver himself or herself. So we are really putting a high priority on using optimal distances to make sure that it's just an efficient system.
I also think it's detrimental to the community and as a whole. I mean, it goes against shopping local, right? Because you've replaced your need to shop and eat within your community, and now you have the option to go get it from 10 miles away. You're cannibalizing your own local restaurant. So I think it's good to keep the zones tight, you know.
Totally.
We've asked you this before, but it may have changed in pertinence to the new digital business. But what is your best business resource to offer, whether it's a book or a website or a person or whatnot?
That's another great question. So one book specifically that we're really jumping into is Measure What Matters. It's all about establishing OKRs, which stand for objectives and key results, made famous by people like Andy Grove and the gentleman who wrote this specific book called John Doerr. And it's just it's a very, you know, tactical way to establish big goals, but that are goals that are completely measurable and allow us to kind of stay, you know, super focused on the things that we need to do to achieve success. So I would recommend that to anybody, no matter what business you're in, but that's something we're using. And to your overall point, you know, one of the things that I think makes us unique, and this goes to our value proposition of being restaurateurs ourselves, is like when we talk to restaurants, which you would think would be a sales call, they're really not sales calls. You know, like we talk to restaurants because we are restaurateurs and we're talking about the industry and business and how things are going. And what naturally occurs, which I love, is this sharing of information. You know, we learn a lot from other brands of things that we can implement in our, you know, portfolios. And sometimes we can also give advice to, you know, younger restaurateurs on how to create a tech stack, or, you know, what's the best method for, you know, developing packaging that keeps your, you know, products at high quality across, you know, delivery distances. So it really feels like, you know, it's like this, you know, we're friends, you know, we're colleagues, cohorts, you know, and not like salespeople. And I love that dynamic of how we're approaching Sesame.
Partners, it's all about being a partner. Well, we love that. We always like to shout out opening soon. So if you have any recent openings that you've been to, or anybody you want to shout out besides Sesame having opened soon.
Yeah. Oh my God. There's so much activity, going on in New York right now. So we'll definitely keep you posted. What's one of the Bandits? We're working on a good friend, Adam Fulton, part of Dan Hospitality. They just opened Bandit. It's actually been a couple months, but it's still relatively new, and we're getting them onboarded onto Sesame, which we're excited about. And there's a soon to come new concept. I hope Evan doesn't get mad that I'm mentioning it, but it's called it's going to be called Old City. And it's the guy who founded Shorty's. You guys know Shorty's, the cheesesteak concept.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they've been around forever. Like, really, really great product. He is relaunching a brand called Old City, and we're excited about them coming either the end of the year or early next. And yeah, and then that concept I told you about up in Harlem is, I'm really excited about this brand.
Amazing. Love it. Shout outs on our end. Well, I want to shout out Alex, who ran the marathon. It's on opening soon, but the marathon day Alex ran the marathon this past Sunday, but I also want to shout out all the chefs and restaurateurs who ran, and it was just such an inspiring day. So congratulations. And it really, like when you said NYC is back, I'm like, marathon day this year felt like NYC was back. It felt so good. So that was awesome. And then also Hungry House, which is the anti-ghost kitchen. They're partnering with people like Woldy Reyes from Woldy Cucina and Martha Hoover's Smash Burgers to have, like, they have a little kiosk in the Navy Yard, and we'll be also doing delivery. So that's launching on Wednesday, which is really exciting.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, you should talk to them. I'll connect you to Kristen, the founder. She's awesome.
I actually know Kristen, I think.
Yep. You better.
She used to be at Zool, right?
She was at Dig In.
Yes, I know exactly who it is. I would love to talk
to her. I'll connect you. You should talk to her. We'll make it happen offline, post-pod.
Yep.
But awesome. We always love having you on the show, just talking to you, and thank you for being such like a thought leader.
Yeah. Tell us, Josh, how we find Sesame.
Sesameorder.com. And it's a web app, so no need to download an app or do anything like that. Again, we are a bit restrictive in our geography. We're now serving 34th Street down to Houston Street, but sesameorder.com. And, you know, you can find us on Instagram at sesameorder. We'd love to get some more follows so we can start to educate everybody out there about, you know, the truths of the industry, and, you know, make sure everyone knows that there's a much better way to participate in a system that gives back to the industry and also can have a real impact on our community.
I agree. And I'm confident that as people learn about it, that you'll have lots of people knocking on your door asking to get in on it and have it grow. So congrats. If you want to find us, we're at Tillit NYC and at We Are Opening Soon. Thanks again, Josh.
Thank you.
Thank you all so much. And congrats on the marathon, Alex.
Opening Soon is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter, enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org, and connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You could also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like,
tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.